How do we build our dreams when we don't know what we want? Learn how Flaunt solves this problem in 5 bold and glittery steps with radio host Laura Cheadle. Using a combination of best girlfriend discussions and therapy-based exercises, listeners are taught how to build their dreams and live their sparkle. Flaunt. Find your fetish, laugh out loud, accept unconditionally, navigate the negative, and trust in your truth.
Welcome to Flaunt, Build Your Dreams and Live Your Sparkle. I'm Laura Cheadle, and today we have got a fantastic show because we have got an Elvis impersonator as our guest. Today we are going to interview Dennis Thornberry, and there are so many things that I like about his story, but he is just, you know, a regular, ordinary guy who ended up with this fantastic second career as an Elvis impersonator. And since my show is all about building your dreams and living your sparkle, I thought he was the perfect guest to bring on and share his experience with you. So with that, welcome to the show, Dennis.
Hi.
I was just hoping you could kind of start in by telling us about your life pre being an Elvis impersonator.
Well, you know, I never really thought about actually becoming an Elvis impersonator / tribute artist or doing it for a living. It just kind of, it's one of those things that you just kind of fall into by accident, or at least I did. I'm sure there's someone out there that did it on purpose, but that's not necessarily the way it happened with me. You know, I've been in entertainment since, as long as I can remember, going through school and everything. I was a bartender, working in nightclubs and bars, got a degree in radio broadcasting, while I was getting my degree, worked in nightclubs as a DJ, kind of kept doing that more than I did any radio stuff because, you know, to start out in radio, minimum wage and raising a family, that doesn't necessarily go hand in hand.
Yeah.
So I made a little bit more money working in nightclubs and stuff like that, DJing. And so, you know, just kind of did that for quite a while, you know, and then karaoke being a big thing. I'd have to MC a karaoke show a couple nights a week on slow times and stuff like that. And, you know, basically refusing to sing myself because I was not going to sing in front of anybody. That's crazy.
Funny.
See, and I would let people come up and sing their songs because I figured, you know, as far as karaoke goes, you're paying money to come in so that you can be the star. Why would you want somebody that's the host singing 90% of the time? So that's what I would do. And I have an unusual sense of humor. I would not necessarily make fun of, but poke fun at people, kind of lightening people up because people can get a little bit serious. And I had a crowd that would come in and just listen to the way that I talk to people. And then that kind of escalated throughout, you know, a couple years. Finally, a big group of regulars came in and went to the manager and said, "This ain't fair. He doesn't sing. So he makes fun of us, and it's all great. The jokes are in good taste, and there's no problem with that. But we can't make fun of him." And so they wanted to put me on the spot. So, you know, I'm like, all right, whatever. Okay, fine, I'll sing.
Right.
So being an Elvis fan for as long as I can remember, you know, and I don't remember ever not being an Elvis fan. In high school and everything was listening to AC/DC. I was listening to Elvis and Buddy Holly and Jerry Lee Lewis and, you know, all the greats, Chuck Berry and all that good stuff. So it was just a natural fit. I'm like, okay, I'll sing an Elvis song. I know this stuff like the back of my hand, so I'll get out there. And, of course, I threw in a couple of Elvis moves and whatnot, and they're like, oh, my gosh, the guy can actually sing. We can't say anything. And so they didn't say anything else about it. They just let me keep making fun of them. And, you know, occasionally they'd go, "My mom's here. Can you sing Happy Birthday as Elvis?" I'm like, what? Are you kidding? All right, whatever. So I'd pop my collar. They thought it was great. And
right.
It just, you know, and over almost a 20-year progression, because I DJed for a long time. Then when my wife and I moved to Colorado, we started our own mobile DJ company. And Then we were looking to branch out, and one day I said, hey, why don't we start booking entertainment? I'll do Elvis since everybody's calling anyway. We'll get some real suits. We'll charge money and make some money doing it. And the rest is history.
Isn't that crazy? Okay, here's what I love about, well, there's several things I love about that story, but I love that you go in and you're just going to sing songs and you're going to throw in moves. And it sounds like in a way you're just goofing around with it. You're just having fun. You're never once thinking, and this is what I'm going to do.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to be like Elvis. No, I just was playing. And that's kind of like how Elvis started too, his very first performance. He was so nervous. He was shaking and moving, and the girls were going crazy. And he goes backstage and asks the manager, what'd I do? I don't know, but get out there and do it again. That's the legend of Elvis right there. So it's kind of the same thing, you know?
No, that is so true. And joy, I mean, just human joy. Whenever we watch somebody in a joyful experience, whether it's singing or dancing or laughing or playing with kids or playing with animals, it's compelling to watch somebody who's having fun.
And we've all seen it. We've seen entertainment where, oh, this guy's struggling, or, you know, it looks like work, and that's not enjoyable. Why would you want to watch somebody work or watch somebody struggle or an uncomfortable situation?
Exactly.
It is much more fun to watch someone that's just having a blast, and that's, you know, I just go out there and have a good time. That's what it's all about.
Okay, so jumping back into your story, you and your wife are in Colorado. You're doing this mobile DJ. You're throwing in some Elvis stuff. How does that work? I mean, are you just kind of randomly thinking, okay, I've got the jumpsuit, I'm going to do songs? Or at that point, do you have an idea of what you're doing yet? Or is it just still, let the universe guide? Who knows? Whatever it will be.
You know, kind of just doing it. There was no plan, no plan whatsoever. It was just, there was an event coming up that we had to DJ, and it was a long day. It was a 4th of July celebration. So we were going to have to fill a bunch of time. And I said, okay, you know, it's perfect. It's actually the 50th anniversary of That's All Right, Mama, because it was 2004. And I said, well, I'll go out there and I'll do a little tribute to Elvis since it's the 50th anniversary, you know. And that was the first actual performance with a jumpsuit and the whole bit. And it just kind of went from there. Went out there and did that. Of course, it probably didn't look as joyful that very first time that I did it.
No.
I'm sure there was people with raised eyebrows going, what is this fool doing? One of the people with the raised eyebrows was probably my wife and family and friends. Mm-hmm. But I've never lacked crazy, so they kind of expect that type of stuff from me.
So literally just one thing led to another. You did that, then you would continue to get booked as Elvis?
Right. We did that one, and then someone that was at the things at that event saw they were doing a car show coming up in September. They said, hey, come do Elvis at the car show. So that was the next one. And then come back and, you know, okay, well, you know, we'll take a break with it. And I had, this is a funny story. I had dyed my hair black because I'm naturally a blonde, like Elvis was a natural blonde. But people expect Elvis to have black hair. So I dyed it black and I'd used some pretty harsh dye, never doing that type of stuff before. So it was pretty rough on my hair. So, we ain't got nothing coming up. I've got about a half inch of growth, so I'll buzz my hair and let it rest. So I went into the bathroom, and my wife hears the clippers going, and she's like, what in the world is he doing? And I come out, and there's a phone call. and a guy down in Colorado Springs, it was the Ritz, actually, down there, wanted a 3-hour tribute to Elvis on his 70th birthday.
Oh my God, 3 hours.
Yeah, I had just cut off all my hair. I'm like, oh my God, what did I just do?
Oh, so how did you pull that off? Did you get a wig?
Well, I sat there and I did everything that I possibly could to make my hair grow faster. This was probably because Elvis's birthday is in January. So I had a couple of months, but it was still a pretty short haircut for Elvis, you know, but you just do what you can do. and we just went with it. It seemed to work, and it just kind of snowballed from there.
So then you started actually practicing the songs and practicing the moves and putting that all together.
Yeah, you know, we started getting, you know, interest and people asking, and I'm like, well, I need to get serious about this. And so I'd started doing even more research, even though I'd been studying Elvis since I was a little kid, reading books and things like that. I just really digging deep, figuring out where the songs came from, who wrote the songs, what they were about, just to kind of really get into it. And, you know, started practicing and putting these shows together, coming up with different outfits, and that first year and a half, it was kind of sketchy and a little bit rough. Within 2 years, we pretty much stopped doing the DJ business, and I was traveling the country doing Elvis all the time.
This is kind of a different career path. What did people think when they found out you were doing this?
Well, you know, like I said, family and friends, they had raised eyebrows. My wife, when I first suggested it, she was like, you got to be kidding me. You know, even though I'm never been a shy person as far as like you put a microphone in my hand and I'm crazy. Being a DJ and stuff in nightclubs doing contests and not afraid of being in front of people. So she didn't, she wasn't surprised that I could do it, just that it was such an unusual, I mean, come on, I'm going to be Elvis.
Right. Right.
Who comes up with that?
But,
nobody. You know, it was, right? You know, because as you're growing up, you know, you have a favorite singer or actor or something. When I grow up, I want to be just like John Wayne. Oh, I want to be just like, and I used to say, I want to be just like Elvis when I grow up. I never knew exactly how much like Elvis I was going to have to be, having all the clothes and the jewelry and the hairstyle. And I haven't seen my blonde hair in 13 years.
Oh, yeah. And then like that, even that, you have a favorite, you have a, hey, I want to be just like Elvis, and then suddenly you really are. And not only are you, but it actually pays the bills.
Right.
I mean, that's amazing.
It's amazing, luck, a little bit of crazy mixed in there. It's unexpected. I've always been involved in music and, you know, being in a DJ since 1990. I've been in entertainment for almost 30 years. It's not surprising that I'm in this particular line of work, but my genre, Elvis, is just a little unusual and it's strange, but it's fun at the same time. You know, because I go places and, you know, I have my own natural hair, so I have to look like this all the time. Which, you know, it gets a little annoying for my wife because people are like, oh, my God, you see all this? We're walking into Chili's, and they're all staring and looking and pointing. And, you know, but what's fun about it is, you know, I'm always met with laughter or smiles or, you know, I'm not the tax man. If the tax man or a policeman shows up, you're like, oh, my gosh, what's going on? Elvis shows
That's
up, you're like, okay, this is cool. Elvis is in the building, you know.
That is so true. Everybody loves Elvis. So you already knew a lot about him because you were a fan, but
right.
Do people now kind of treat you like Elvis, and have you found that you have had to learn more and more and more about him and his life?
You know, not having to, but having, being a little bit of OCD and kind of a perfectionist, I don't want to look like an idiot or a fool when I'm talking to a fan and they've seen a show and they start talking about a particular time in Elvis's life or something that he did,
right.
And I have no idea what they're talking about. You kind of really want to get deep into it. And some of the knowledge that I've gained is by pure accident because, you know, traveling the country, I've been lucky enough to meet people who actually met Elvis. And so they'll tell me stories. And so I get some of the inside information, which is kind of cool. So, you know, some of it I've learned by accident, by meeting people that knew him or that met him. Others, I you know, they've got Elvis Radio on Sirius. We listen to that constantly to get new information. or reading books, or, you know, Google is a fantastic thing.
Oh, yeah. So what is one of the most interesting stories or people that you've met about Elvis?
There's several. Let's see. I've got, we were doing some shows down in Texas, and during the week, we don't have much to do. Bars, restaurants, stuff like that, they don't want to book anything on a Wednesday. So while we're in a town or something, we'll go to nursing homes and assisted livings and stuff like that and do shows there. Mm-hmm. Just to keep ourselves busy until weekend. Otherwise, you're sitting there from Monday until Thursday with nothing to do. So we're traveling around and doing shows like that. And we were in a nursing home, and someone that worked there said she knew this one lady knew Elvis. And
wow.
I said, "Oh, that's cool. That's cool. You should go talk to her." Well, I'll talk to her after the show. Hey, you know, and I get people saying stuff like that all the time, and then they'll come tell me the story, and either the story isn't right, or there might be a date or something. That seems a little fishy. People,
right.
You know, because they mix up their memories and stuff. But I started talking to this lady, and I got her name, and she actually dated Elvis. There's a registry, a list of known girlfriends. Mm-hmm. There were several over the years of groupies and people that snuck into dressing rooms and stuff like that, but girls that were known to have dated Elvis, and she's on that list.
Wow.
And so she had some stories and, you know, some neat insights, and, you know, the sad thing is it wasn't a very nice place. It was one of the older type of nursing homes. And, you know, while I was talking to her and getting some of the stories and things that she said, she couldn't say very much. She was pretty sick. I just couldn't help but have the feeling that if Elvis knew that she was in a place like that, he would change it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
He would make sure that he put the money forward to put her in a nicer place, that she'd get better care. Because that's one of the things that I have learned the most about Elvis, is that anybody I've ever met that knew him or met him or saw him never had anything bad to say about him. He was always a nice, generous soul. And that's one of the things that I want to portray when I'm, you know, if I'm representing Elvis, you know, you can't be a jerk, you know, but, and part of that story, you know, talking to her and stuff, the creepy part of that was, you know, she looked up and she grabbed me at one point. She says, "I can tell you have the same spirit as Elvis."
Oh.
And that coming from someone that knew him pretty closely, that means a lot. And so, yeah, I got stories like that. Then I got some more fun, lighthearted stories, you know.
Yeah.
I've met a lot of the guys up in Denver that were on the security detail when he would come into Denver. You know, and Elvis has a lot of history with Colorado and Denver.
Yes, he does. He does. I have heard that. Wasn't he an honorary, because I'm an Elvis fan, but it's deep in my brain.
Yeah.
Wasn't he an honorary police officer out of Denver?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, he was.
Yeah.
He was honorary in a lot of towns, and if they gave him a badge, it actually was good. He could arrest people. And
oh,
he
really?
He had one in Memphis, and he would get bored, and he would get in his old beat-up pickup truck, and he had a little light, and he would pull people over and say, "You're driving too fast on my road." And he would come into Denver, and he wanted to do a ride-along one time with some police officers that he knew, and they got some approval for him to do it, but he was supposed to be low-key. He was supposed to wear normal clothes. Don't be flashy. We don't want to be driving around with Elvis in the back of the police car.
Right.
You know, we don't want a bunch of news here because we still have to do our job and all this kind of stuff. He shows up for the ride-along. Of course, this is the 70s, and he's decked out. He's got all the bling. Rings on every finger, big giant jewelry around his neck, the big giant collars. You know, just if you just picture Elvis in the 70s, just the epitome of Elvis in the 70s. That's exactly the way he showed up. And they've got a big, long story, and there's books out there. You can find these guys all the time up in Denver doing little things. And they've got books about these stories. But I can just imagine some police officers pulling me over and saying, hey, you know, up against the wall. And then all of a sudden Elvis grabs me and throws me up against the side of the car and starts frisking me. And I'm looking around. That's Elvis.
Right.
That would be a weird situation to me.
That
like,
would be
okay,
really
I'm not taking
weird.
This seriously. Where's the cameras?
So what else is his history with Denver?
He would come in, of course, do shows.
Okay.
There's a bunch of different stories. Like one time, Lisa Marie was 8 years old, and she mm-hmm. mentioned to him, I've never seen snow. He called to make sure that there was snow in Denver. He got on the plane. They flew into Denver, let her play with the snow on the tarmac for a minute, and got back on the plane and left.
Oh, my goodness.
They had our rental in Vail. They'd go up there quite a bit and do stuff. But just coming in, he got to know the police officers really well. One of the police chief at the time, he would come in on a sabbatical and just stay at the guy's house. They had an extra bedroom,
wow.
and he would just come in and hide there and just hang out and be a part of the family. And let's see, there's a gentleman up there in Denver. His name is Nick, and he has a cafe. It's Nick's Cafe. It's on Sims and 6th.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was 17 years old, he was working in a place, the Colorado Mining Company, and they came to him at one point during the day and said, hey, can you stay open late for a VIP? He needs to come in and have dinner about 2 o'clock. And, oh, sure, yeah, we can do that. And so he is doing all his regular cleanup. The people show up. They sit down. He goes out there to take their order. And lo and behold, it's Elvis. And so, he asked Elvis what he would like. And he was, I need 2 cheeseburgers and a big plate of fries. And he goes, unless you suggest something. He said, well, we do have something on the menu. It's called the Fool's Gold Sandwich. It's a full 1-pound loaf of Italian bread. We split it in half. We take a full jar of peanut butter, which is 16 ounces. So there's another pound of food you put on there. And then we take a full jar of blueberry preserves at the time is what they used and spread that on there. And then we take a full pound of crispy bacon and put it on there. That's the sandwich. And he goes, that sounds good. I want 2 of those. I'm like, are you kidding me? And a plate of fruit. So he brought it out there, and Nick will tell you, if you get a chance to talk to him, he didn't eat both sandwiches because that's a lot of food. He just, he wanted to make sure he had plenty, so he just ordered 2. And so there was kind of there's a bunch of stories that go on from there with that sandwich. It became one of his favorites. He flew in one time and asked Nick to bring 50 sandwiches to the Denver airport. And, They met there. Nick went on the plane. He went on the Lisa Marie, sat there on, everybody knows if you've been to Graceland and you've been on the plane, the mm-hmm. blue velvet bed. He sat on the edge of the bed. Here's a 17-year-old boy that brought a bunch of sandwiches sitting on an airplane talking to Elvis Presley. And he's got a bunch of stories. So if you ever get a chance, anybody out there, you're up in, here's a shameless plug, up in Denver, go to Nick's Cafe. And he would be glad to tell you any stories that he has about Elvis.
Have you met any of, like, Lisa Marie or Priscilla? Have you met anybody like that in your line of work?
I haven't. A lot of the people that I've met are secondary people, mm-hmm. Security detail, people like Nick, ex-girlfriends. I was in Nevada here not long ago, and I was watching this one band, and during a break, the drummer comes walking up to me and he says, do you like Elvis? I can tell by the haircut. You must. Oh, yeah, definitely. And so he started talking to me. And he was the drummer from 69 to 77 for the Sweet Inspirations. Opened up the show for Elvis in 76. The organization came to him and said, okay, now, Ronnie Tutt, the drummer for Elvis, his wife is pregnant and stuff, and he might need some days off here coming up, so we need to try you out as a fill-in drummer for Elvis. So he actually did play on stage as Elvis's drummer a couple of times. So that guy had some cool stories. And the coolest thing is he had his backstage, still had his backstage badge that said TCB on it, band member. And he carried it around in his pocket, and I was like, oh, that's really cool. So, I mean, I've got
that
to meet
is.
People like that, but directly, Lisa Marie, Priscilla, that would be really cool to meet them, but I haven't ever been in the right place at the right time to do that.
Exactly. Okay, now, I know there are a lot of people worldwide who do Elvis stuff, you know, whether it's just looking alike or singing or performing or whatever. Are there any, like, networks of Elvis performers, or do you meet other performers? And how does that work with, you know, the relationship between the performers?
There can be a lot of competition. There can, and there are competitions that you go to. And you know, I know a lot of guys. There's let's see, I think there's probably 8 or 9 on my Facebook right now that I keep in contact with on a regular basis. Guys out of Phoenix and up in Northern California and stuff like that. And you know, when I'm in their town, we always go have lunch or we meet up somewhere and stuff like that. So there's small networks, and you know, the 9 guys that I know, they know 20 other guys. And so there's a network that way. And like I said, there are competitions. There's one coming up every weekend, just about leading up to August, because everybody wants to be the ultimate Elvis. So there's always competitions, and you know, we'll go to those every once in a while, just as a networking thing. And I use it as a learning tool, because when I watch Elvis, everything I see Elvis do is Elvis, and to pick out something that, you know, oh, that's a signature move. That's something that I need to do in my show. It's kind of hard to do when you're watching Elvis, because everything he does is Elvis. You know what I mean? So you want like a specific, you know, knee jerk or, you know, an arm movement or a look on his face or something. And so seeing other guys, I'll watch him and I'll go, that reminded me of Elvis right there. That was an Elvis move. And so, yeah, I'll steal that particular thing, or, you know, I'll bring that into my act or something like that. So, you know, we'll use it as a networking or a learning tool or something, and going and meeting with the guys. Which, you know, can be an unusual situation. It is really weird when you're in a room with 20 to 50 guys, all that black cloth hair, the high collars and the jewelry. It is a weird situation. And
it's got to be.
My wife and I say we have a running joke between the two of us that we want one of those, because everybody's getting those tattoos with the sayings on their forearms and stuff. Ours is, we do the weirdest stuff.
Oh, how funny.
Because we end up in the weirdest places doing this. We you know, when you're down in the green room and there's 30 guys and everybody's, you know, they're getting in character and they're all male, you know, you walk up and, hey, how you doing? You know, I'm from Colorado. Oh, I'm doing all right, man. All right, man. I know you don't really talk like that. Don't talk to me that way. Come on, break the character for half a second. It's strange, you know, and I'll walk into those rooms and I'll go, okay, this is what's really weird, is that we're all supposed to look like the same guy, but each and every Elvis impersonator out there, unless you're one of those with a lot of money and you want to go do facial surgery and look more like Elvis, we all have our own look and our own style. And it couldn't be more different. I mean, I was in one, this is about 2 or 3 years ago. It was in Laughlin, Nevada. And I'm downstairs with all these guys. I'm like, this is so weird. That guy looks like Count Chocula. That guy looks like Frankenstein. That one looks like Alan Thicke. Every guy had, one guy looked like David Copperfield dressed as Elvis. It was just kind of a surreal, of like, okay, we all have an Elvis look, but we all look like somebody else.
Oh, yeah, and I love how you said that, how everybody has, like, the different look or the different move, but you can still embody Elvis, because sometimes I'll look at somebody and I'll think, wow, they look like a great Elvis, but they start singing or start moving, and it's just not there. And then same thing, other times somebody will come out on stage and you'll think, well, they don't really look like Elvis, but all of a sudden the moves are there, and you're feeling that. So, yeah, it's neat. It's all the different little pieces coming together.
That's the full experience. And that's one of the reasons why I started getting real serious about it. You know, before I started doing this, my wife and I had taken a trip out to Vegas, my first trip to Vegas ever, about 15 years ago. And of course, at the time, and it's getting fewer and fewer as the years go on, but there was a lot of Elvi everywhere. And I'm seeing these guys, and, you know, I go into a place and I sit down to listen to a guy. You know, I would hear the people around me talking, well, if you turn your head and close your eyes, you can almost imagine Elvis is in the room. I'm like, well, that's not why you go see a live performance. So
no.
That struck me as weird. It's like you want the whole experience. You don't just want to, you know, because if I want to hear Elvis, I can hear Elvis. I can get records. I can get footage. And the internet's been great. So if I want to listen to Elvis, I will listen to Elvis. I'm not going to go pay money, sit there, and close my eyes and listen to a guy, you know. And it's great if someone's got the chops to sound exactly like Elvis, but you want to give people the full experience. And, you know, along with that, you want something that's attractive, because
yes.
We've all seen some pretty unattractive people, that, you know, it's like, when Elvis passed away, he was 250 pounds. So a guy weighing 475, that's not Elvis. To me, that's disrespectful. And you know, I starve myself. I get on the treadmill and I run as often as I can get a chance to try and stay in performance shape, because I feel the fans deserve someone that physically fit. Because when Elvis was in his prime, that guy was trouble. I mean,
yes.
He was just, if you watch the 68 comeback special, if you watch 73, the Aloha, you know, any of that type of stuff, anything before 75, you can get some pretty off-color stuff if you start getting a little bit later when he was getting thicker. But, you know, 73, 74, you could find him up there doing the, and karate, he would just stop the show and just do karate for 20 minutes because he wanted people to know that, you know, he was physically fit. But you want to portray that. You want the look. You want the fancy clothes. So we try and have as close to a replica of something he would have worn as we can possibly do. And everything I've got is pretty spot on to something that he wore at one time or another. The gold jacket or the black leather outfit or any of the jumpsuits, you know, we have the ones that look just like the ones that he had. Because you don't want to see something that looks like they went to Walmart or the Halloween store and bought a cheap little outfit. That's not what you want to pay money to see. You want the full experience. And that's the thing about Elvis fans. I mean, you know, he's been gone 40 years, but they just don't want to let him go. They want a piece of him here, and that's why it works to be able to do this, because just giving them a little hint of, you know, Elvis still on this earth.
I love what you said about being respectful to him, because earlier you had mentioned he was a good person. He was a very generous person. You know, people all have their own faults and their flaws and their things that they overcome, but his heart was good, his soul was good, his spirit was good. And I think that's part of the reason people still want him on earth. That's part of the reason that people, I mean, want that experience. Of course, he was a phenomenal singer. His, you know, moves were second to none, but he couldn't have pulled that off if he was a jerk to people.
Right.
And I appreciate that you embody that spirit as well, because that you do trust Elvis. You want to be with Elvis, and that's very respectful. And and then at the end, when, you know, he did gain the weight, he was sick. There were some physical problems going on, and there's a difference between being the, you know, quote-unquote fat Elvis parody and really honoring a human being who went through some pretty tough medical conditions. And that's just rude.
It is. It's really rude. And, of course, we're faced with that type of stuff all the time. People, you know, they'll see me and you know, when we go into a place and, oh, there's an Elvis guy, you know, they feel the need to just spurt out the first thing that comes to mind. And most of the time, it's good stuff, and people say nice things, and they're happy to see me. And then you get rude people. Oh, I thought you were dead. Or, you know, oh, don't go to the toilet, you know, or, you know, just really rude stuff, you know. I was at a convention in Vegas one time, and I was the only place I could get ready was in a public restroom. A guy saw me go in there. I went into the stall. I look up. There's a camera up above, and the guy's taking a picture of me changing in the stall.
No.
And I'm like, hey, dude. And I went running out there. I'm like, what are you doing? Give me that. You can't. No. He goes, no, I'll just get a picture of Elvis in the toilet, man. You get that the bad stuff that's attached to it. That people, regular mainstream media, they latch onto something and they just beat it to death. And that's one of the things that they beat to death was the fact that he was sick the last couple of years. And, you know, he put on some weight. You know, the funny thing is if you start researching and looking at Elvis, I got a picture of him getting on a plane 6 weeks before he passed away. He looked like a typical, normal 42-year-old man, a little bit thicker than we would be at 21. Come on, it happens to the best of us. But he wasn't huge. And then by the time he died, that last image of him, it almost looked like a bee sting. And if you get into the history of it and you really start researching, there was a very dangerous combination of drugs, prescription drugs that were in his system that he almost had an allergic reaction to. And there's a lot of stuff that goes with it. And I don't even, when people talk to me about that or they say, oh, I thought you were dead, or what, I ignore them and I just walk away. Because the reason why I do this is to bring happiness, to bring something that you might have forgotten about, you know. And when, you know, I'm kneeling down and I'm singing Can't Help Falling in Love to a 80-year-old woman, 90-year-old woman, and she's got tears in her eyes because it brought back a memory, then that's why I do what I do. You know, and I've got some stories, you know, from being in nursing homes, like the one from the lady that dated him. Those are the moments that I latch onto when I have people that just want to be jerks about the Elvis thing, you know. What I do and why I do it is to bring those memories back, to bring happiness to people, to see the smiles on their faces. It's just being an entertainer, and you know that, just entertaining people. It's such a blessing, and it's a gift. And, you know, talent is just talent until you give it to someone else, and then it becomes a gift. And so keeping it to yourself, that's just, you know. So I spread it around as much as I can, which is why we're on the road 90% of the time. We spent 2 months at home last year total. That's driving in 2 days, changing everything, repacking, cleaning stuff, getting in the car, leaving again.
Wow.
And we're gone all the time. But, you know, our kids are grown, so no big deal. We miss the grandkids and stuff like that. And sometimes we get to take the grandbaby on tour with us. So that's awesome, and we have fun doing that. It's being able to spread the joy and the love that was Elvis. Because, and I've heard people say this when they were at a concert, even if they were in Houston Astrodome with thousands of people, when Elvis was on stage, they felt like they were alone in the room with him, because that's the way he made people feel, like you're the only one that matters. You know, if I could just touch on that just a little bit when I'm doing a show or when I'm entertaining people as Elvis, if I could make them feel as special as he made people feel and bring a little bit of that back, then I've done my job.
What a gift. I mean, what a gift to honestly bring this to people. You're spreading joy. You're spreading happiness. You're continuing this positive thing. And, that's phenomenal. I mean, talk about a life well lived. You absolutely are living your life well by doing that for people. And I love that you recognize that it's a gift. And I had not heard that, you know, about talent is not a gift until you share it and you give it away. I love that.
Right. My sister said that one time. And I'm not sure where she got the quote. Knowing my sister, she probably came up with it on her own. But it's such a perfect thing. You know, I know people that play guitar, they won't play in front of anybody. I'm like, well, you've got to share this. That's what this is for. That's what, you know, I know this is something that's a release for you, but it's just talent until you give it away, and then it becomes a gift. And that means so much in so many, you can use that in nursing. You know, you can be a good nurse, but unless you really, no matter what it is, if you have that frame of mind that you share it with another person, then it becomes, mm-hmm. you know, it becomes something special. We have our moments, you know, we look at each other, my wife and I, and we go, oh man, I just can't do this anymore. This is a rough life. And then we'll go to a nursing home and we'll have one of those moments that just kind of just hits you in the face. Like, oh my gosh, that really just happened.
I need to do it.
And so you go, okay, well, I guess we can't give up. You know, we got to keep going. And uh-huh. we do. And, you know, there's hard times. Anytime you're on the road, it's rough. It's a rough life in and out of hotels and, you know, the checks in the mail. We've all heard that. That gets a little tough from time to time. Oh, the checks in the mail. Oh, well, that's good because I'm 800 miles away from home and I do not have a mailbox on my car. And I need a hotel room for this evening. But, you know, we just keep going. And that's usually when we start getting that far down, you know, going, oh, this is rough. That's when something happens. And you know, mm-hmm. of course, you know, you have the Lord above or whoever you are, whatever you're thinking, the universe that comes in, steps in, and lets you know that you're on the right path. And it happens on a daily basis.
Oh, I'm sure. And, you know, I have to just honor you and thank you for saying that, because this show is all about, you know, FLAUNT is an acronym for finding your fetish, which you did, laughing out loud, which you do, accepting unconditionally. You know, this is what it looks like, and this is what I have to do, and these are the sacrifices that I make, which you're doing. Navigating the negative. There's negatives in everything, and it doesn't matter if, you know, God or whoever comes down and says, do this, and you say, okay, there's still going to be negative things that you have to manage, because we're here on Earth, and it's challenging, and you have to manage all that, manage other people's negativity, manage the demons inside, manage life. And just by trusting the last part of FLAUNT is T, trusting your truth, just trusting that this is where I need to be, and having the strength and the courage to move through that is huge. And well, I like that you acknowledge, yes, it's hard, but it's okay.
Yep, it's hard. You have your challenges on a daily basis, things that come up, whether it's the traveling or, you know, the performance or whatever it might be, you know. There's always going to be someone out there that does what you do and they do it better, or they look better, or they, whatever it might be. And you have those challenges on a daily basis, but you know, it is what it is. And you know, if you go out and you put a smile on someone's face, it doesn't matter. That's when it just doesn't matter anymore. Because you know, you've brought back a memory. You've made them smile. You've made them happy. You've made them think about their problems for a minute, and you know, your problems seem smaller when you're in that situation.
Now, do you have any favorite stories about a time where you really suddenly it became apparent to you that you are on the right path and this is exactly what you need to be doing? Do you have any favorite stories about that?
Yeah, there's quite a few of those. We're traveling around doing some shows in Florida about 5-6 years ago, and we were in a nursing home. It was a pretty elevated care. People were pretty sick, and we're doing a show, and those shows can be kind of rough. As you can imagine, it's pretty quiet. They don't really clap or applaud or dance or, you know, that type of stuff. But we're doing this show, and I'm going around, and just like always, you know, I'm singing Can't Help Falling in Love, and I always find a lady, and I reach out, and I grab her hand, and I make sure I make eye contact with them and sing the song and make them know that I know that they're there. And I'm doing this, and there's a lady that's laying in a it's a chair, and I can't remember the technical term, but it also lays down and so that they can actually sleep. It's called anyway. So
yeah,
she's laying there, kind of at a three quarter, just sitting there watching the show, being nice and quiet. And I go over and I'm singing the song, and I grab her hand, and she's looking at me in the eyes, and she's singing along, and she knows all the words, and you know, I'm not thinking anything about this. It's something that happens all the time. And all of a sudden, all the nurses, the staff, CNAs, whatnot, they start crowding around, and they're pointing, and they're covering their mouths, and they're talking to each other, and they're whispering back and forth. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what's going on? I'm like, am I doing something wrong? And so I finish, and I go to the next song, and then they tell me at the end of the show that the reason why they were freaking out was the fact that that person had been in there for 3 years. She had been catatonic for 3 years, had not spoken, responded to another person, even her family, in 3 years. That was the first time they had seen her come out of her catatonic state and respond to another human being. So you have, I know, it's giving chills to me just thinking about it.
It's making me cry.
When you have a moment like that where something, some power greater than you has come through and has touched another person, you gotta keep doing it. I mean, why would you stop? You know, because if I can have even just that one moment, that means all the rest of it is, you know, anything that bad could possibly happen is worth it. I've got stories like that, and that's probably one of the more extreme, where it's like, oh my gosh, you know, it was either a memory of Elvis or that song or something was in the deep recesses of her mind that she came out. Even for that brief moment, they saw that she could actually come out of that catatonic state, and there might be hope. And so that story right there, that's probably the creme de la creme of the stories that I've watched.
Oh, that's amazing. And yeah, I've seen people around you, and it is interesting, you know, again, nothing that dramatic, but everybody screams and they throw themselves at you and they jump up and down, and it's just pure joy. It's pure excitement. And you're right, it's touching something in people, and that's got to make every moment worth it.
It is. Those are the moments that happen when we are on a lull, you know, or we're feeling down, or we're feeling, you know, just exhausted. We've been on the road 2 months, and we've been eating the wrong kind of food and been staying in the wrong kind of places, and we're just done.
Done.
And then you'll have a moment like that, and it brings you back. And,
exactly.
It puts that fire back in there, and you keep on going and keep living the dream, as you would say.
Now, would you be comfortable talking as Elvis or singing as Elvis or just sharing any of that on the air today?
Well, I guess I could. Oh, man, it's Elvis. He's over there. And that's what's funny is that you got all kinds of different people do that voice, and you have the joke. There was a cartoon years ago, Johnny Bravo, and he kind of, okay, he's going on the kind of the joke thing, and our granddaughter has a show she watches, Dinosaur Train, and they have a dinosaur that talks like that. Oh, the world of the money, man. And you know, so there's so many people that draw on such a, either they get on the joke, or, you know, they kind of just, they try and be more like the real thing. You know, Elvis didn't walk around going, thank you very much. You would think someone was had something mentally wrong with them if they did that. Even though that right there is the number one thing people say to me when they see me. Oh, thank you very much, man. Thank you very much. Oh, shut up.
I'm sure.
If I had a penny for every time I heard someone say that, I could buy everybody that is listening a brand new Cadillac.
I bet you could.
But you know, there's interviews that you can go on. Like one of my favorite quotes is, "I rock and roll music, man. If you like it, you can able to move to it." And that's what happens to me. You know, that's one of my favorite quotes. He didn't like being called the pelvis, and you know, and that's the cool thing about Elvis is that he was a comeback. Every piece of his career, he was making a comeback. He started, he did a couple of songs, people go, oh, get him out of here, rock and roll is the devil's music, and so he had to prove that, no. So he came back, and then he started doing movies, and oh, no, no, he's just this cheesy movie star, he's not a singer anymore, so he had to come back. And he did the 60th comeback special. And then, you know, he had to reinvent himself so many different times, and each time he did, he became, I don't know, a better Elvis, but I would almost say better, because he would just go into, you know, just different types of music, different genres, and expand his craft. He never stuck with one thing. He could have stuck with the rockabilly, where he was just singing the rock and roll and rockabilly, but he wanted to show people that he could sing, so he would do songs like It's Now or Never, and well, the boy's got a voice, you know. And then he'd do, in the 70s, he's doing American Trilogy. Or to me, he embodies entertainment because he reinvented himself to show, basically just to be Elvis, just to continue to be Elvis. He would reinvent himself to show that he wasn't this myth or this joke that people were making him out to be. And he had to deal with that on a, you know, a regular basis, you know. Starting from the beginning, when he was just, he's contributing to juvenile delinquency.
He didn't give in to that. You're right. He overcame it.
Yep, he overcame the whole thing. And just, you know, and so he kind of embodies what your show is about, living the dream, and, you know, just going past the people out there that are the naysayers that are trying to tell you you shouldn't be doing this, you should stop. He dealt with it on a daily basis. And that's one of the moments where I feel like Elvis, is when I'm having to go up against the brick walls. Because you deal with it on a constant basis. Every day there's something. Someone getting mad at you because you won't let the guy just rest in peace. Or, you know, someone go, oh, no, we don't want an Elvis show. That's not cool. Or, you know, whatever it might be. He had the same brick walls that he faced. You know, oh, you're just Elvis. You're a cheesy actor. Or, oh, you just do that tongue-in-cheek rock and roll. And he had to face that. And those are the moments where I feel the most like Elvis, is when I'm having to face some of the same adversity.
Yeah. And, you know, had he not been pressured that way, had he not had his critics, perhaps he wouldn't have developed as amazing as he did. You know, so perhaps people criticizing and saying this is the devil's music and he's, you know, just a cheesy actor, perhaps some of that pressure really helped create him and ended up being a huge blessing.
Invention comes from necessity. And you know, if you don't have a reason to have something or do something, you're just going to sit there, oh, who cares? So we're not going to invent something. So in order to better yourself as an entertainer or whatever it might be in your life, you have to be challenged, and you have to be told that, well, you're kind of stale right now. You need to, we need to step up the game a little bit. And having that adversity, having people say, oh, you're singing the devil's music. Okay, fine. I'm going to go on Ed Sullivan. I'm going to sing Peace in the Valley. And they went, oh, well, this is a normal, decent Christian young man. He's, you know.
Oh, his gospel albums are some of my favorite ever. They're incredible.
Oh, same here. The gospel music that he did, the passion that is in his voice. You know, and that's one of the things, too, privately that I do when I'm having those moments of lack of faith, which happens to the best of us. If I listen to his gospel music, and that belief, that strength that he had in that belief, it brings mine back. You know, it helps my faith, being able to listen to that. You know, if people out there haven't really listened to the gospel music that he's got, you need to, because it's incredible.
And also, it doesn't really matter what faith tradition you come from. You're right. It's this power and this conviction in his voice that just takes you right back to whatever belief it is that you have. And it's all-encompassing, and it's warm, and it's loving, and it's right. strong. I mean, it's just solid.
Yeah, just knowing that there's someone out there that has a strength and a faith that's that strong gives you the hope that there's something better in those moments where you think that there's not. You know,
oh, absolutely.
And so you listen to the conviction in his voice, even on some of the simplest songs. And, you know, you believe his love for his Lord when he's singing the gospel songs more than you do
yes.
when he's singing a love song. You know,
yes, you do.
Love songs, you know, it's like, okay, he's singing a song to a girl, you know, or in the movies, he'd sing a song to a bull or something like that.
Oh, exactly.
You know, you believe his conviction when he sings those songs. Some of the people might not know, 22-year career, thousands of songs, 33 movies. He only got
wow.
3 Grammy Awards, and it was all for gospel music.
Interesting. Yeah, and he deserved them. Let's just put it
yeah.
that way. He absolutely deserved them. Thank you so, so much for your time and for being brave enough to just go out and live this dream, for heeding the call, for being passionate, committed, connected, and for bringing so much joy to the planet and to all of the people that you touch. And I was hoping you could close out the interview with a few bars of a song if you want.
Before we go, I do want to say thank you to the universe and to the Lord above for blessing me and letting me do this.
Yes.
Because, you know, it puts a good feeling in my heart to be able to make people happy and to bring these memories back to them. And it is a lot of fun, a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun. And if it wasn't for the Lord above, you know, letting me tread on and giving me the strength to do it, I'd probably be pushing boxes somewhere. So let's end everything with a little bit of All Shook Up.
Let's
well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm hurting, oh, out of the bug, I'm in love. I'm all shook up. Thank you very much.
Tune in next time to Flaunt. Build your dreams, live your sparkle with radio host Laura Cheadle every Wednesday at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Dream Vision 7 Radio Network. Come release outdated labels, roles, and scripts. Reveal the calling of your soul and re-choreograph your own life, even when you're unsure of what you want. In 5 bold and glittering strokes, you too can build your dreams and live your sparkle. Find out more about Laura at pyramidfusion.com.